Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Judge Ginger Lerner Wren. Judge Lerner Wren pioneered the first therapeutic mental health court in the United States, which is dedicated to the safe decriminalization of people with mental illness and neurological disorders. She recently wrote a book entitled A Court of Refuge, Stories from the Bench of America's First Mental Health Court. In our conversation, Judge Lerner Wren discusses her own story of becoming a judge and mental health advocate, and her passion for social justice, particularly on behalf of those who live with mental illness. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Judge Ginger Lerner Wren, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Pastor, I'm so delighted to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Well, I always am interested and curious to talk to folks and learn how they got into their own vocation. So I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your own path, about entering the law and becoming a judge.
I can. You know, I think that I'm also very fascinated by that because I'm really intrigued how people find their path after being off their path. And I guess I can say I'm one of those individuals, I feel, that had a little challenge in finding my path. And so, you know, I went to law school because I really wanted to make a difference in the world. And I got out of law school and I could not find the right fit. I really was very interested in human services. I was interested in doing civil rights work. And there were just absolutely no doors opening for me in that regard. And after a few years, and I was doing well, I was doing, you know, real estate work and corporate transactional work. And to some people, you know, for example, I was financially doing well, and they might have viewed that as, wow, you know, you're really successful starting out of law school. And instead, I just was really beginning to feel despair in terms that maybe I had made a mistake. And so what I did was at that point, I had a daughter, a baby, little girl, and she was about 18 months old. And I decided, you know what, I'm just going to take my nest egg and I'm going to just do some mommying and spend some time with my daughter and start to maybe create some space for myself to reevaluate where I belong, and was law right for me or something else. And sure enough, during that time frame, I heard about this wonderful position that opened up or was going to open up, and it was called a public guardian of Broward County. It was an office that was a court program. And it was for adults who had been deemed by the probate court to be in need of legal guardianship. They could not care for themselves. They were indigent. They had no family that could serve as their guardians. And the program was looking for essentially a new director. And I just knew in my heart of hearts that that was, in fact, you know, my job. And sure enough, I worked very hard to prepare for that position. I ultimately got it, loved it. I worked with social workers. I was a lawyer, social worker, administrator. It was just a very robust position. And it wasn't too long that I guess I had given a speech with regards to a segment of my population that I was serving as public guardian that were patients at the state psychiatric hospital in our region, basically almost the southern half of the state of Florida. It was a very large psychiatric institution that the state was threatening to close. And I got up and I spoke, and ultimately I was offered a position to oversee a federal class action related to that psychiatric institution. And I really felt very compelled to take that position because as I had been serving as public guardian, I had basically within a period of 10 days, I mean, if you want to consider it maybe a miracle, it was certainly an inspired experience. But within a period of 10 days, three different families came to my office unannounced in extreme angst, despair. Their family members were in crisis. They needed help with getting mental health services. And each family said exactly the same thing, that somebody told them, never identifying who that may be, but somebody told them that I could help their mother or their sister or their father get mental health care. And I didn't know who would have said that. I couldn't even take these people into the program given the criteria. And I made on the very last family that I remember walking down, you know, this carpeted corridor to an elevator, I just made like a private promise that if I ever had a chance to help these families, I would. And sure enough, I got a phone call, you know, in regards to overseeing this class action over at the state hospital that happened to be located in my county. And of course, you know, I would never have said no. And one thing led to another, and I really gained the experience and the very unique skill sets that I really needed to be able to start a mental health court ultimately.
So let's talk a little bit about that. And I would imagine you spend, especially as you are promoting the book that you just wrote that just came out, about what a mental health court is. And so what is your typical way of explaining that? When I've talked to folks and told them I was going to interview you, there's always that, what exactly is a mental health court? There's a bit of a puzzled look on their face. I'm sure you get that a lot.
Well, I don't get that too much. Okay. But, you know, that's because that's what I do. And the mental health court was the first mental health court of the United States. And the mental health court comes under the banner, if you will, of a specialized problem-solving court. And I'm sure many of your viewers are familiar, for example, with drug courts. And the very first drug court in the United States, ironically, also started in South Florida, started in Miami-Dade in 1989. Back then, it was under former Attorney General Janet Reno, who then was the state attorney for Miami-Dade, recognized that people were just flooding into their jail system largely because of addiction. And without treatment, all they were doing was literally setting up a revolving door. People's lives were being ruined. And from a health vantage point, nobody was being offered care. And so in Miami-Dade, they began what was the first problem-solving treatment court. It uses a very unique legal law reform philosophy called therapeutic jurisprudence, also known as TJ, in the field. And TJ basically conceptualizes a court, the invisible ways in which courts and judges have the ability to impact the people that are before them in terms of how we communicate. Are we caring? Are we, you know, rehabilitative, or are we just acting more, you know, a robotic, mechanical in some sense, just rule by rule by rule? Or can, in fact, we take courts of law and really convert them into agents of recovery and wellness? And that really is the idea behind TJ. Can courts heal? And so the drug courts, of course, became very, very popularized And from there, there have been therapeutic problem solving, domestic violence courts. And then, of course, mental health courts came online in 1997. When I came to the judiciary, we recognized that our jail was really becoming quite overcrowded, and largely there was a high prevalence of individuals being arrested simply because they couldn't access mental health care in the community. And that really is what a problem-solving court does. It tries to get to root cause. It addresses vexing social problems where there might be resource gaps or policy vacuums, and a community wants to create change. And I give great credit to my community for an awakening that we just cannot go and blindly incarcerate people largely because they're ill.
I'm fascinated by this question that you lift up as to whether courts can heal. And I'm wondering if you receive pushback from others in law to that question, who would say that's not the court's job. Is that a debate at all, or?
Not so much.
Okay.
In the beginning, I think, you know, there's always some interesting scholarship, I think, in that area. But, you know, problem-solving courts now are just what we call, what some people call smart justice. That, in fact, we suffer from in the United States, you know, mass incarceration is just a really, really just out of control social problem, economic problem, criminal justice problem, public health problem, you name it, and it's a problem. And so all of these strategies from a legal vantage point that we could put in place that begin to really take the criminal justice system and try to bring more integrity to what it's doing in terms of sentencing structures, in terms of bail reform, in terms of offering treatment to those who are ill over incarceration and not to misuse jails. And so it's a complicated problem, and I'm oversimplifying, but I feel that every state now, usually in my survey, has a wide variety of problem-solving courts.
Well, it seems like there's obviously a large debate in our country around healthcare, and people go back and forth. And I think for the most part, when people talk about healthcare, they, in my opinion, too often think just about physical healthcare, and they don't talk enough about mental healthcare too. And it seems like too often state legislators see that as a place to cut budgets. And so you have a really interesting quote in your book from an individual named Michael Perlin who said, "Individuals with mental disabilities have been outsiders in the world of human rights law." So I'm wondering to get your own opinion on the state of mental health in our country today. And that's a really big question. And why do you think it is that individuals with mental disabilities are outsiders?
First of all, thank you for bringing that up. Thank you for quoting Professor Perlin, who not only is a dear, dear friend of mine, but when I got the green light from the chief judge to start this court, and I really needed experts to help guide me because I knew if I didn't get it right, I was going to blow like the biggest opportunity of a lifetime. And I just didn't want to fail. I know that failing, you know, leads to opportunity. But in this case, Pastor, I just felt like I had be as perfect as I can with all of these considerations in law, constitutional law, you know, from a ethical vantage point, from an interpersonal vantage point, from a dignity vantage point, a moral vantage point, and of course, from a legal vantage point. So Professor Perlin, I called him out of the blue. He is one of our global leaders in constitutional law, disability rights law, and human rights. And I basically just asked him if he would be my constitutional law consultant. As I told him about the concept of the court, he agreed right away. And the reason, you know, that individuals with serious mental illnesses, of course, are so stigmatized and discriminated against, of course, goes back to early civilization. You know, we could spend weeks talking about how that derived, but the truth of the matter is that even today, with what we know about behavioral health care and, you know, medicine and mental health is essential to overall health. And, you know, we have all the data and, of course, the research and facts. And yet, to a large degree, still our jails across the United States are acting as de facto psychiatric hospitals. As we speak, there's an estimated 400,000 people that really, many, not all, but deserve to be in humane therapeutic healthcare settings, treatment settings, and yet they're behind bars largely because of access to care. That's called discrimination. And Professor Perlin speaks and writes for many years about the institutional bias and prejudice, the hidden prejudice, if you will, oftentimes not so hidden, as to individuals with mental illnesses, which is no different, you know, than any other ism, whether it's racism or anything else. Discrimination is a huge factor, which is why Broward's Mental Health Court has, you know, began as a human rights strategy.
This may tie into it too, that in my own understanding and reading of mental illness, and it seems so misunderstood, and at least in our church, I know at times we are with folks who live with mental illness and go through moments of feeling, I should just get over this. I should be able to snap out of it. And then when they can't, they have this feeling of failure, and then that leads to despondency. And I would imagine you see that over and over in your court because of the stigmatization, and they feel like, well, it's just in my head. I should just be able to just think positive thoughts or do X, Y, and Z and get over it. Do you see that a lot in your court?
I do, you know, and I feel like, you know, we all know that if we have a fever or we're sick or we have a broken arm or, you know, we're all educated. We have a basic, you know, working knowledge of healthcare, and we know that we need to get to a physician. It's the same thing with mental health. And I spend a tremendous amount of time. I have a clinician, a fabulous handpicked licensed clinical social worker that's been with the court, therapeutically guided this court now for 20 years. And we spend a tremendous amount of time in court simply doing behavioral health literacy, teaching as we go, and really trying to take aim at dispelling the misunderstanding and mythologies surrounding mental illnesses. It's no different than any other health problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of my podcast talks about resiliency and perseverance. And in one chapter, when you talk about the power of human connection, and you talk about the support that family and friends give folks who are in your court, and it helps give them resiliency who live with mental illness. I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about that, about the power of connection and how that helps them through this process.
I can. You know, and I, it goes back, first of all, just to having somebody believe in you and have what I would always describe as an abiding belief in recovery. I've heard so many, you know, many years ago, I was fortunate to be appointed by President George W. Bush to be on the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. It was the second presidential commission that we had in the United States, the first one under President Jimmy Carter, which, of course, that was a nudge by Rosalind, his wife, who's such a extraordinary champion for mental health for so many years. And, you know, under the New Freedom Commission, it was the first time ever that we talked about mental health policy in terms of recovery and wellness, that it's possible. And, you know, I just remember listening to all of this testimony, because we worked for a year very intensively taking public testimony and listening to so many people. And what resonated, first of all, was the lack of hope, that no family members, no individuals. Nobody was being offered hope that people get better. Mental health people were being told that they can't go back to college, they can't have relationships, that they're not going to be able to work, that they'll forever be disabled. It could be farther from the truth. And so, to number one, just to know and to have hope and to have somebody, it doesn't even have to be a lot of people, but even one person who believes in you, who has an abiding belief that you can recover, who talks about your strengths and your dreams and your visions. And it's not magic. I mean, this is healthcare. I mean, you know, people get better and they go back to college and their relationships and fall in love and, you know, when their spirituality, of course, becomes activated. And so it's so human connection is, of course, I think we know that it really is the foundation, you know, as we are supposed to be connected, to love one another, to have empathy, to support one another. And I mean, that's really what humanism is, I believe, and to take care of one another. And so to have somebody who believes in you is really so important.
Well, it gives me personally hope too, to know that there are people in the justice system who want to give hope to others. That's very clear that you, part of your own in working with folks who come through your court and making sure justice is done, but also I sense your desire to make sure that hope is there too.
It's true. And, you know, how do you define justice? You know, and I just feel that justice is more than a judge, you know, bringing forth an adjudicatory ruling, you know, and looking over the case law and hearing from both sides. But if we're dealing with human rights, if we're dealing, you know, with the knowledge and we're not in denial that you've got people on a conveyor belt, literally going into jail simply because they can't get access to healthcare, then social justice, like homelessness, like access to care, just basic nutrition and clean water and clean air and environment. I mean, all of these basic needs is really part of the paradigm of justice.
Yeah. Well, I was really moved by the story that you tell in the book about a woman named Rosemarie. And how she seemed to be a success story at first. And you write about how you were driving in the rain one day and saw her in not a very successful situation. I was wondering if you could tell that story for the listeners and then also kind of the own struggles that you have as you try to help individuals who come through your court and that sense of, I don't know if you feel when they don't make progress, do you feel responsibility for that, that you may have quote unquote failed? So I'll kind of stop there and ask if you could kind of share that story.
I think that's just a great question. I think that's a really poignant story too, about feeling like I failed or we failed or the system failed or she failed. I don't even know. But, you know, Rosemarie in this story, that wasn't, of course, her real name, but there really was this person who got linked and connected, you know, with just really wonderful treatment providers. She spent over a year and we had we have a different version of it now, but for almost a decade, we had our own homeless shelter that supported the court. It was called the Cottages in the Pines. And so she had stayed in our homeless shelter for a very long time. And she was just doing so incredibly well that she was so committed to her recovery that I remember I got invited to a very large mental health conference down in Miami-Dade. I asked her if she would like to come and join me and actually join me on stage and speak to the audience. It was in the early years of the court and people were very curious about the court, and I felt best out of the people who are being served, of course. And she did such an amazing job. And, you know, as things, you know, people in my division, in my court, we don't have standard timelines. People can stay as long as they want, or they don't have to stay at all. It's a voluntary court. And typically we try not to keep people tethered to the criminal justice system. And ultimately, she was on her own. And, you know, fast forward then, you know, almost 10 years, and I'm driving down the street running errands with my children. And I see this woman who looks vaguely familiar. She was wearing really dirty, tattered clothing, and she had her face kind of painted or tattooed like, and she didn't even have proper shoes. And I saw this very large police officer, like kind of towering over her. And I went, oh my gosh, maybe he doesn't know that, you know, she's mentally ill. Maybe I need to do something. I just can't let her go to jail. I don't know if it was a right decision, not a right decision. But I pulled over very, no pun intended, gingerly walked toward where this encounter was and kept my distance so the police officer wouldn't feel I was interfering with whatever he was doing. And I simply identified myself and I said, you know, I thought it was important that you know that actually not only is this person have mental illness, but she also has a developmental intellectual disability, which is true. And this officer must have been having a very bad day. And he got very irate. Luckily, he just kind of, I guess luckily, he didn't do anything negative. He just said, you know, if you want her, this was his truth comment. He goes, if you want her, you can have her. And just jumped in his patrol car and tore away. And unfortunately, Rosemary didn't even recognize me. She was in a psychotic state. It was actually a very frightening experience at the time. And ultimately, though, I did get in touch with her case manager, who said, you know, they had just, you know, they had lost touch. And I guess she just stopped adhering to her care and her health really deteriorated.
You ask yourself in the book, you talk about this kind of internal question that you ask yourself, was there nothing I could do to help her? Which I think my hunch is, and in some conversations I've had who love those who live with mental illness, that's a question that comes up again and again. Is there anything more that I can do? Is there nothing I can do to help them? How do you, I guess, it would be easy to, I would think, to beat yourself up with that question. And how do you help yourself to kind of, to ask yourself the question, but not continually be too hard on yourself?
Well, first of all, I think that it's good to have people around you as you do, Pastor, I am sure that you could talk to. You know, and I do, I talk to my staff. They're kind of like my support team too. So we could talk things out. And I say, you know, I really feel bad. I just feel bad. You know, I just don't want people to suffer. You want people to make good choices, but people are making choices and you do need to honor choice. And, you know, what we do know, and I do have an expertise, thankfully, in psychiatric rehabilitation. And I know that readiness to care, adherence to care, you know, it's not always a straight line and not everybody's ready. And I think that we see this in the area of addiction, you know, and it's really tragic, particularly now with the opioid epidemic. And, you know, there's so much risk and so forth. But we never close a door. We keep a door open. And I tell people, if you change your mind, you don't have to get arrested to walk into the courtroom, and we'll be glad to offer you whatever help we can. And I think that that's also an illustration. On one hand, it's also dignity. You know, it tells people that you care and respect them, but you're not judging them. I pride myself on saying I'm probably one of the most non-judgmental judges, you know, walking. I really do try, you know, to maintain that view.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could say more. This is interesting. You have an interesting quote in your book where you say, "For me, the greatest failing of the court stems from my idealism." I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I mean, I remember being a young law student. And back when I was in law school, they didn't teach us about the criminalization of people with mental illnesses. We really didn't have mental health law, for example, is actually a very young field. Started in the 80s. I graduated from law school in 1983. And I remember when I first learned about it, I have to tell you, Pastor, I was shocked. All I kept thinking was, how could this be? How could this be in America? Of all places, that people who are ill are being incarcerated. When everyone knows they're ill, it's not a secret because a vast majority of people are getting arrested in psychotic conditions when in fact they need to be hospitalized. Like if you're having a heart attack, you don't go into jail, you go into a hospital setting. And I think that I don't know that I'm ever any less idealistic, but I certainly am wiser and maybe somewhat disappointed that I really felt that if we brought the work of the court, the problem solving, the good, the bad, the ugly, the pain, the sorrow, the joy, if we did it out in the open, in a courtroom that everybody can see and listen and hear and feel it, and you know, that our policymakers would stand up and go, this is an outrage. We have got to fix this. And that was 21 years ago. And, you know, even though, for example, the Broward's Mental Health Court has diverted over 20,000 people out of our jail, and that's just part-time. I have a regular criminal division. But I just think that that idealism, in one sense, was a failing, and in another sense was an amazing feat, because what if I'd never believed that it could be fixed? And I just went along in this mediocre, you know, path that, oh, it's no big deal. No, it's a big deal. This is an urgent matter. This is life and death. And I guess my biggest failing is probably my greatest feat. And that is that we have never lost, you know, that sense of urgency or alarm, or, you know, we have got to help, you know, Ms. Jones, we've got to help this person. We cannot keep them in jail, you know, for one more second. And I think that that failing is probably our greatest success.
Well, your energy is contagious. And are there days when you wake up, though, and the energy is just not quite there for you? And when that happens, what keeps you going? What keeps you going on those days?
That is such a great question. And I bet you, you know, that people will relate to this. Like, oh, gosh, you know, you go, oh, my gosh, you know, I didn't sleep well, I'm tired, whatever. Just the grind, the simple grind sometimes, you know, of life and everyday stressors and worrying about bills or this or that, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, you turn on your humanism and you put only that person in your sights and you remember what you're there for, and you might be the only person that they've got. And then all of a sudden, I feel healed. It's like amazing. And I'll turn to one of my court staff. I go, oh my God, I love this court. I mean, I love this court because I feel alive. And maybe that is the clue that you're doing the work that you're supposed to be doing.
So the constant, continual human connection continues to help you.
It does. I mean, being able to be vulnerable, being able to look at somebody you don't know and say, you know what, you know, I really care about you. And I can tell right away, you know, that you have got incredible strengths. And, you know, people are just to hear that from a judge, forget about it. You know, they are like, they probably want to fall down. But yet it's so deep and it's so real. And it just, I don't know. It lifts me up. And I think that if our goal is to restore personhood to people who have been marginalized and people who have been forgotten about and people who are largely, you know, invisible, that restoring personhood, I think that I thought, well, if the court fails, at the very least, people will know that we really care.
I'm grateful for that comment. I usually end by asking folks to share a story of failure from their own life, a time perhaps where they may not be, they stub their toe, or this can be professional or personal or whatever. So I'm wondering if you could maybe share a story with the listeners today.
No. I mean, I just, you know, I feel, well, I can't. I mean, I don't feel that way. I feel, I mean, I guess I don't. I think that I'm a really, honestly, I am so tied in to ensuring that people understand that perseverance and grit and never giving up and, you know, never, even if things get so bad that if you just look for your helpers, you know, they'll appear. And I never want to do anything or say anything because I don't really believe that. Even that's really how I live. That people, if you want to make changes and you need help, helpers will come. Somewhat of a, maybe it's somewhat of a spiritual type of belief system, but yet, or an inspired belief system, but I really believe that failings are more like disruptions that really could turn into great gifts.
Yes, okay. Well, Judge Ginger Lerner-Wren, her latest book is A Court of Refuge, Stories from the Bench of America's First Mental Health Court, and you can get that on any of your favorites, from many of your favorite booksellers. Judge, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Pastor. It was a delight. And thank you for all the work that you do.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Judge Lerner-Wren for giving her time for this conversation. Her book, again, is A Court of Refuge, Stories from the Bench of America's First Mental Health Court. And you can also follow her on Twitter, at Judge Wren. That's W-R-E-N. Thank you again for listening. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast, as I'll have another conversation in a couple of weeks. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Thanks again.